an AA meeting? My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I'm going to introduce tonight's speaker. This clubhouse has a women's meeting at 5:45 that I reluctantly started a long time ago because I don't like women's meetings. But it's pretty popular, and so I met Jeffrey there, and she is awesome, and I look forward to hearing her message.
Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Jeffrey, and I am an alcoholic. Okay, my sobriety date is February 26, 1996, but I do this one day at a time. My first name is Jeffrey, and I'm very used to people being curious about my name. And if I'm going to explain that so that no one here is making up stuff in their head or thinks anything strange. But my name is Jeffrey. I was named by my dad, and he was a World War II vet. And when he shipped out to Europe, the last thing he said to my mother was, honey, if I make it through this, when I get home, we'll have our Jeffrey. Well, he did make it. And several years later, it took a while, here I am. So my name is very special to me. Now, I've said my name is Jeffrey, and then I said, and I am an alcoholic. So those words, I am an alcoholic, are the most important words that I say in my life, that I have ever said in my life, because I am admitting that I am powerless over alcohol. I'm admitting that I am powerless over people, places, and things. I cannot fix, change, or control anyone. I cannot read your minds, and if you could read mine, you would have bolted by now. So, my disease of alcoholism exists for one purpose, just me personally, and that's to kill me. That is to kill me. And in doing so, it's going to take out people that I really love, family members, etc. But the life-saving news that I have that I've learned in here is that there is a solution, and that applying these 12 steps, the 12 traditions, saved my life and helped me to deal with life as life approaches me. The choice is mine. Now, I want to say just one moment about my higher power, whom I choose to call God. And that's how I will be referring to my higher power, God. But I honor everyone, every single power that's in this room, very much so. I'm always interested in knowing how people, where your higher powers are and how that works for you. I personally believe that all of our higher powers coming together keeps us sober, helps us get well. So, these are very, very lofty words. My ego is really pleased right now that I've put that together. And I wish I could say thanks for letting me share and we could all go home. But that would be less than brutally honest. I was very fortunate when I first came in the program that my craving and desire for the substance of alcohol itself was taken from me very early on. I don't know how or why that happened, but I know that it did. I've had many experiences. All of my experiences in recovery are God moments, and that certainly was one. I need to come here on a regular basis. I need these meetings. I need each of you. When I got here, I was very alone. I was spiritually bankrupt, and my old friend, Pop Off Vodka, had betrayed me. No longer worked. I was full of all the selves. Selfishness, self-loathing, self-sabotage, self, 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 ego, ego, ego. However, my one motivation was that I did not want my daughter or my husband, especially my daughter, to see me die drunk. She'd seen me drunk enough. So I determined that I would come here and you'd show me how to get sober, and then I had a plan. That's what I walked in the door with. Now, I was born in southeastern Kentucky. I am the daughter of families of coal miners and farmers, as well as families who have a generational history of alcoholism, as far back as our family research goes. And we ain't drinking from bars. We're making it in the backyard. In our family, my dad was an alcoholic, and in our family, drinking and handling one's liquor was a rite of passage. People who couldn't handle their liquor were weak, cowards, and a disgrace to their family. We didn't ask for help. We closed ranks, and we didn't need anyone, and no one needed us. My daddy was a really interesting, complicated guy, and let me say right now, I love him so much. I love him so much, and I wouldn't trade one minute of being his daughter. But he had an ego that was larger than mine, if that's possible. And I was his girl. And he told me that. He told me that I was perfect, that I could do nothing wrong, and that if something happened out there in the world, you just come home to Daddy and I'll fix it. I'll show them to mess around with my girl. And, you know, that was the beginning. And he did this with a good intent because he had had a violent, brutal childhood. But that was when I can remember that I started to hide, and that if I did mess up, I sure wasn't going to tell Daddy because he might die. You know, his little girl was not perfect. That's when I really started lying and manipulating and hiding. My first experience with alcohol happened when I was about 5 or 6 years old. So I had my own little beer mug. It was like this. It was really cute. Later on, I got a glass with my name on it. I'm at home, I'm a kid. I was always excited when Daddy came home from work because he would share some of his beer with me. And I loved it. I couldn't wait for him to get home. I loved the smell. I loved the taste. And most of all, I loved the tingle. That first tingle, but I learned later on that first tingle was never enough for me. My dad had a job that he accepted a job that required our family to move a lot. So we moved around the United States during my childhood and adolescence a lot. I went to 13 schools and 4 high schools before going to college. I was the new girl, but I was smart, and I developed. That's where I developed the. I call it my wardrobe, that I could. Or the rooms where actors get ready to go on, makeup room, because I could walk into a cafeteria and size up the crowd pretty quickly. I could tell cool kids, smart kids, hellraisers, drinkers, bingo, and I could adapt myself to whatever the my need might be at any given time. This was the beginning of tools that I used throughout my life to survive, to deal with the world. Manipulation, masking, pretending to be something that I was not, or pretending to be something that you wanted me to be so you would like me and you would ask me home to play with you. That's a very difficult juggling act. It's very difficult. And as a result of all of that, I quickly, over time, lost sight of who I was. Who was Jeffrey? What's making her tick? That happened pretty quickly. When I got here, I didn't have a clue. I came in here as a, you know, a maybe 10-year-old, emotionally immature. I didn't know how to make decisions. I had this kind of like entitlement spirit that I expected to be taken care of, just like Daddy taking care of me, just like later my husband would take care of me. So I drank through high school without any major consequences, and as my daddy said, I never showed out. It was important in our family, if you were a woman and you were drinking, that you better not show out. That meant that you were, people would think you were a whore or worse. So I'm really proud that I never, there are worse things, right? Okay. So I never suffered major consequences, and even then, I really preferred to drink alone. I like to drink my way. I've never had patience with normal drinkers. I never really went to bars. I just never liked it. Couldn't drink like I wanted. I didn't drink to be sociable or make friends. Sometimes to pick up guys before I was married, but I drank to drink, and that was all I cared about. So in my freshman year of college, I met my husband, and we became the center of one another's lives. He was a normal drinker, and my drinking eased up considerably because I really wanted to hang on to this guy. He was a good one, a keeper. So college was good. But again, I was pretending. I very much wanted him to marry me, and we'd have kids, and life would be great, and I'd never drink again. So by the time we were married, shortly after we were married, my drinking was, I couldn't keep it quiet anymore, and it was out in the open. You know, I had 2 blackouts on our honeymoon. And, I'm sure my husband was, I don't know that he had any idea how serious my drinking was. And I can only imagine his feelings as he sees his new bride, passed out on the bed and coming to understand that she was a powder keg and she could be set off by a couple of shots of vodka. And then who knows what would happen. Now, there were times after we were first married that I tried white-knuckling it. That did not work. That did not work for me. My husband never knew what to expect from me, and these are his words. I was walking on eggshells. I never knew who you were. I kept waiting for you to be my girl, but she was gone. My girl was gone. And that's him talking, not me. So we have. I was a raging drunk. So when I got drunk, it wasn't to dance and have a good time. I was mad. I was angry, and I let it go. I was emotionally abusive to my husband, and treated him very badly. We would have, horrible yelling fights, which were pointless, and that was his words too. I don't know what I was thinking. So, and I would always you know, cry and the next day and apologize and promise to do better and, gee, I really love you, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, get drunk again. Now, I did drink primarily by myself. I could usually manage social situations, but only with a buzz on and with the anticipation of getting really bombed when I got home. My husband, again, bore the brunt of my active alcoholism. And I've suffered a lot, remorseful and guilt and all of that related to my behavior towards him. But I came to realize, and this with the help of my sponsor, that that kind of remorse and guilt is not part of what we're told up here. And that it was taking my energy away from living my life. And I also came to understand that he was a grown man. He was a smart guy. And there were no bars on the doors. You know, I didn't put him in chains. He could have walked anytime, but he didn't. And for whatever reason, he was a great saint or a great fool, but he stayed. You know, I when our daughter came along, I decided I was, this was a dream come true for me. I'd always wanted to have children. And when she came along, I thought, well, my drinking is over. Why would I possibly want to be drunk and take care of this baby? But we all know how that story goes. But I really counted on her to help me stop drinking. And in the end, she did help me. She still helps me. Now, I never put her in danger, but I walked a fine line. You know, a very fine line, and, you know, the grace of God, my higher power, that we came through it, she came through those years physically fine. I was never abusive to her. My husband took on a lot of the caring for her, and that was one of the reasons I think he stayed. So I can't identify a specific event that brought me to admitting complete defeat. I knew that over all this time that my husband loved me very much, but I also knew that his commitment to our daughter overshadowed any commitment that he might have to me. And I was desperate not to lose them. The episodes of destructive drinking had increased. I would get drunk and go out and drive, and my favorite thing was to get really drunk and go to Burger King because a Whopper usually got me halfway sober. I know. Whoppers work great on a hangover, too, in case you're interested. So there I was. I had lost myself. I'd lost my best friend, vodka. I'd been betrayed. I sat alone in my car one very cold morning in a vacant parking lot, and I don't know what happened. I believe this is God, but I just knew that I knew that I knew. And that's probably the only time in my life I'd had that head-heart-gut connection, that there were no words. I just knew. I was very, very tired and sick. I was looking for a reason to remain in the world. And I can't explain all of this. All I know is that that was the day. That was my time. That's my experience. Comes differently for each and every one of us. I found myself in an outpatient treatment program, which I had arranged for myself because I thought I could avoid going to AA. Going to AA would be an admittance of my failure to handle my liquor. Oh, no. I was numb and terrified. I didn't want to keep coming back. I didn't want you to be happy. I wanted you to see my pain and suffering. I wanted you to care for me because I was complicated and cute and really bringing something to the group. You know, we can laugh about it now. So I'm in this outpatient treatment program, and part of their deal was you had to go to an AA meeting, and you had to go, like, you know, within a couple of days of getting there, and I didn't want to go, but I kept my daughter's picture very close to me. I still do, and I could look at it and say, well, okay, you know, if this is what it takes, this is what it takes. My first meeting was a women's meeting here in Atlanta, and I'm, as a new girl, I'm really accustomed to walking into a room and not knowing anyone, being a stranger. And you know what? That new girl experience was not quite as intense, walking in that room. And the women were very nice to me and kind and welcomed me, but they didn't pat me on the back and say, everything's going to be just fine. You know, we're just so glad you're here. Let's go to coffee. It's going to be all right. Do you have a sponsor? I didn't hear any of that, and I didn't need to hear that then. All I needed was to have the trust in these women to sit down and listen. And that's what I did for a really long time. And I found out that I liked meetings. I gradually grew to really like meetings. And again, God helped me to understand that if I was going to make it, that the answer was in a meeting with other alcoholics. I didn't see any other way. So I eventually met my sponsor, and she has been my sponsor for these 25 years. We've had a few off and on times, but she has been my only sponsor. That works for us. Doesn't work for everybody. She also loves me enough that when I have a particular issue or problem that she does not have experience in, she loves me enough to say, you know, I understand what you're I don't understand your experience because I haven't had it, but I care about you enough. I'm going to suggest you talk with so-and-so who has gone through exactly what you're going through. She is very humble, and I love her very much. So when I walked into that women's meeting, the women were so welcoming and gushing, and I was numb and embarrassed. And for whatever reason, I picked up my first white chip and my only white chip that day. I don't know how that happened. It doesn't matter. I call it God, call it what you like, but there I was. And from that point, I was told everything had to change. Everything about me, my life, my relationships, everything had to change. And I didn't know how that was going to happen because, remember, I was going to get sober to take myself out. So what was really the point? And I didn't share that with anyone. But gradually, over time, the meetings became more and more important in my life. And my sponsor started going through the steps with me. And these 12 steps, these 12 traditions have saved my life on a daily basis. So it was suggested to me in the beginning that I take the steps slowly. And I'm glad that I did. I spent a really long time on steps 1, 2, and 3 because I was told over and over, get this one right. These first three steps are the foundation of my sobriety. Step 4, making a searchless and fearless moral inventory of myself. Well, I didn't have any problem with that. I had a whole list, litany, of things that were wrong with me, that I'd done wrong, on and on and on. And taking the mask off and really looking at myself, honestly, was healing and the beginning of a new freedom, a new happiness. In steps 6 and 7, I learned about humility. I thought humility was being a coward. In steps 8 and 9, I learned to deal with remorse and to take responsibility for my actions and to start cleaning up the wreckage of my past. 10 and 11, again, gave me accountability to my God. And in step 12, I learned that I cannot keep my serenity. I cannot stay sober unless I give freely what has been given to me. I was pushed into service work fairly early on, and my first job, this is at another clubhouse, was straightening the pamphlet rack, you know, and that's what I could do. And then I graduated to having the pamphlets mailed to my house, and I was just thrilled. I came from a corporate job, and that was the best that I could do. I don't think I've ever been more proud of anything I've done at work but handling those damn pamphlets. And I hope they're all straight. I think they're all straight. Okay. All right. So, again, I wish I could say thanks for letting me share, and we can all go home. But I need to be brutally honest. I'm called to be brutally honest. So I've been sober about 14 years when I had a really up close and personal experience with the monster I call alcoholism. Now I know what my disease looks like. I call it a he. I know what he tastes like. I know what he smells like. I know where he's sitting right now. I know him. He looks a little like Rumpelstiltskin. And he smells. And he's not the guy you want to go to dinner with. And he knows how to work me. So I started hearing things like, you know, you've been at this AA thing a while. You've been to the best of AA probably in the United States in Atlanta. You've graduated from the AA school right here in Atlanta. You've got a graduate degree. You can do this. Take a break. You haven't had a drink in a long time. And I listened. So here's how this program has worked for me. I didn't drink. The craving for the substance of alcohol has never come back to me, thank you God, just for right now. But within about 2 weeks, I was the raging bitch was back in action. It took just that long for everything that I had learned in here that had been shared with me to go out the window. And the worst part was that I couldn't control my behavior. It's just like drinking. I couldn't control it. And I knew that I was hurting my husband. I knew that, you know, staggering around drunk in the kitchen is not a good thing for anyone. And I couldn't stop. My husband, I don't know how he stayed. I don't know. That's not for me to decide. That's for him to talk about or for him. But he did finally seek outside help. And for whatever reason, God, life got better. For one thing, he stopped reacting to me, and that was no fun at all. That was... And the other thing that I would do to torment him was I'd steal his car keys and hide them. So in the morning, he didn't know where they were to go to work or whatever, and I couldn't, when I was drinking, I couldn't remember where I put them. So this time, when I was raging bitch again, he had a second set of car keys made. And so that problem, he didn't have to worry about anymore. But life got better. And I knew, you know, we learn from pain. I learned from pain. And from that pain, I learned that left to my own devices, I will drink again. That's it. I will drink again. And if God, for whatever reason, he and Rumpelstiltskin got together and said, let's give her a whirl, Rumpelstiltskin, my disease, lost out, but God won, or that particular time. And I came very close to losing everything that I had gained. So I had to come back to AA. I knew that. Just like when I had the moment in the car, I knew that I knew. It's no fun being rageful and mean and controlling and all the time. It's for me, was exhausting, and I hated myself. I really detested myself. So I came back to AA and started coming here to NABA, and I reconnected with my sponsor. It was interesting because the first time I came to NABA was in the small room over here at the 930, which is my home group, I Can't We Can. And I looked across the way, the chairs, and there she sat. And we hadn't seen each other in a couple of years. And it was, you know, again, a God thing. I started building a new network of women, and I do have male friends in here too. I started doing service work again. I started sharing meetings. Eventually, I became our group's GSR, and I came out of isolation. And I learned also that isolation is red zone territory for me, and it happens. It can happen very quickly. For me, there's a big difference between isolation, lonely, and alone. I don't have a problem being alone anymore, but I do have a problem with isolation or with alone, or that feeling of, you know, well, here I am. What, you know, what's next? No one cares, you know. Self-pity. I have to distinguish between those. Isolation is when I don't go to a meeting, when I start making excuses, when I don't pick, you know, it doesn't matter if I call 20 people in my contact list and no one answers. That's not isolating. That's reaching out. It's doing something. Isolation is the red zone, as I said, for me. So, the most traumatic event in my sobriety and in my personal life ever occurred almost 5 years ago when I lost my beloved husband of 39 years to pancreatic cancer. Now, words do not hint at the impact of his loss on myself and my daughter. And I really, with all my fiber, everything I've got up here, I wouldn't be here today without him. I would be dead or in jail, had my child taken from me, who knows. But I honor him by saying that. And then a few months later, my sister died of ovarian cancer. And here's the miracle in all of this. Throughout the time that he was dying, was sick, and he died, the thought of a drink never occurred to me. In fact, I was consumed with love. Love for him, love for God, love for our child. I don't need any further proof that AA works, but that I was present for him. I loved him to death. And that's probably the greatest gift this program has given to me and to him. Now, my sobriety does not provide me with a free pass to avoid the traumas of life. I am one among many who experience sorrow, regrets, loss, pain. I'm not alone. There is always someone within the fellowship who shares my experience. Always. I have to be honest and open. Masking this kind of pain, just, you know, disaster for me. However, as I said, I do not choose to have myself defined by grief. You know, poor me, look at me, look how brave I am. You know, I don't like that at all. But what I can say through all of this is that I am an alcoholic. And when I am an alcoholic in this fellowship, that means I've found a solution and that the choice of using it is up to me. So, I've been given many gifts in this program. You all loved me back into love. You loved me back into joy. You made it worth getting up off the couch and coming here because I had work to do. I had people I was sponsoring. I still do. And I was accountable to you. I felt that. I was accountable to my sponsor. Love back in here. Also called upon the fact that, you know, in the big book it says we are not a glum lot. Well, I don't want to be glum. That's not who I really am. And one of the most difficult things in here for me to learn, especially early on, is that it's okay to have fun. It is okay to laugh. It is okay. It's all right. I am a human being, and part of being a human being is taking joy in all that is out there. I don't mean that to sound cheesy or like a Hallmark card, but I know for me personally, I denied myself a lot of the joy and fun of life, like dancing. I've always loved to dance. My husband and I danced together every day of our marriage. No matter how mad he was at me, he would come in the kitchen and go, "Come on. Come on, let's do this." And we kept that promise. So that is the place where I feel pure joy that I wouldn't have without this program. So my daughter was 12 years old when I got here, and she had seen Mom drunk a lot. She'd seen Mom on the kitchen floor with a broken wrist and a blackout. My girl is 37, and she's married. She has a 2-year-old child, my grandson, and she and I have a wonderful relationship. Wonderful is not a big enough word. And she called me before I came over here tonight because she knew I was doing this, and she said, "Mom, I'm with you. I'm so proud of you." She said, "I never take you for granted." Now, I'll take that. I spend a lot of time with my little grandson. We've been juggling childcare because of COVID issues. And she lets me be with him alone. She lets me pick him up in his childcare in Midtown Atlanta and drive him home on I-20. Now, I'll take that level of trust. You bet. So I've always been touched. Oh, and by the way, my husband said, "Tell them about us. Tell them about us." My marriage was restored. It wasn't perfect. It was complicated. There were some very challenging times, and we sought help. We committed to being willing. We committed to our love, and we asked God to help us. And, and he said to me at one point, "I've got my girl back." Now, will I take that? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So I'm always touched by in the promises where we read or say, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I love that word, painstaking. It doesn't say, just give it a try. And it doesn't say, well, you'll do better tomorrow, or I know you're tired. Try again another time. Try, you know, wait till after Christmas. No, it says painstaking. And it works. It works. There's no easier, softer way. The answer is right here with each of you. I've never talked to another alcoholic that I have not learned something from, ever. And it's usually the people that irritate me the most that I learn the most from. And I don't like that, but it's true. It's true. It doesn't matter. I love all of you, and I wish you a slow recovery. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.